Kiev in recent days, the Maidan Independence Square has turned into a full-scale war zone.
More clashes in Ukraine's capital, Kiev.
There is absolutely no doubt that snipers are working here. I've counted 10 bodies.
Now on the brink of a civil war, at least 70 dead so far, and the death toll rising.
What we saw here today was a revolution.
We've invested over $5 billion to assist Ukraine in these and other goals.
NATO has expanded into 13 countries, up to the borders of Russia. 13 countries.
The focus has to be on not allowing this crisis to turn into hot war between Ukraine and Russia.
Ukraine. It's an ancient and proud land with a rich history filled with much beauty, heroism, and sacrifice. Ukraine is a borderland, a place where east meets west. This is the flag of Ukraine. The blue represents the sky. The gold, its seemingly endless fields of wheat. Ukraine is a prize many have sought, and much blood has spilled in the quest to possess it. Ukraine has been the pathway for Western powers as they attempted to conquer the East in World War I. And World War II. And every time, the Ukrainian people ended up paying the highest price for these grand games of power. History doesn't repeat, but it surely rhymes, said Mark Twain. If one looks closely at the history of Ukraine, one will notice many rhymes. Being surrounded by stronger powers, Ukraine has needed a lot of cunning to survive, and the art they truly mastered with time is the art of changing sides. In the middle of the 17th century, Ukrainian leader Bogdan Khmelnytsky broke a truce agreement made with Poland, siding with more powerful Russia. Just over 50 years later, as the Russian-Swedish War was raging, another Ukrainian leader, Ivan Mazepa, broke the union with Russia when he switched sides, joining forces with the Swedish invaders. Many times, Ukrainian history was written by third parties. Seeking to keep the gains of a revolution at any cost, Russia agreed to the humiliating conditions of the Brest-Litovsk Treaty of 1918, which turned Ukraine into a German protectorate. Another historical document that changed the fate of Ukraine was the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1939, one of many such agreements being signed between European countries and rising Germany. Attempting to protect his nation from the approaching Nazi threat, Joseph Stalin negotiated a treaty of non-aggression with Adolf Hitler. While promising each other peace, the Soviet and German foreign ministers Molotov and Ribbentrop realigned the map of Eastern Europe, splitting it into German and Soviet spheres of influence. No sooner had the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact been signed than Poland was split. And in September of 1939, Eastern Poland awoke to be Western Ukraine and a part of the family of Soviet republics and the USSR. But even this bold dividing of lands and nations only delayed the inevitable. Germany broke its promise to the USSR. On June 22, 1941, Germany invaded the USSR, launching Barbarossa, the largest military operation in world history. Barbarossa was aiming for St. Petersburg, Moscow, and Kiev, Ukraine, three destinations of major significance. Ukraine, with its rich lands and resources, was an important industrial and economic source for the USSR. To cut it off from the Soviet Union would strike a big blow indeed. For most of the Soviet Union, the Second World War was about fighting the invaders of their land. But it wasn't quite so simple for Ukraine. The truth is, Ukraine has never been a united country. When World War II broke out, a large part of Western Ukraine's population welcomed the German soldiers as liberators from the recently forced upon them Soviet rule and openly collaborated with the Germans. The real scale of collaboration was not announced for many years after the war, but we now know that whole divisions and battalions were formed by Ukrainian collaborators, such as SS Galician, Noctigal, and Roland battalions. Just in the beginning of the war, more than 80,000 people from Galicina region voluntarily enrolled into Division SS Galician in a month and a half, notorious for their extreme cruelty towards the Polish, Jewish, and Russian people on the territory of Ukraine. Members of these military groups came mostly from the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, the OUN, founded in 1929. This organization had an ultimate goal of creating an ethnically pure, independent Ukraine, and considered terror an acceptable tool for achieving their ends. Their official flag was black and red, land and blood. It will remain in Ukraine's history long after the OUN will cease to exist. In early 1940, the most radical nationalistic part of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists got its own leader, Stepan Bandera. Severely anti-Semitic and anti-communist, he proclaimed an independent Ukraine in 1941. His German allies frowned upon such an act of self-will, and it landed him in prison for nearly all the Second World War. Not participating in the events physically, Bandera still managed to successfully spread his ideology. Many independent historians estimate that the OUN militia exterminated from 150,000 to 200,000 Jews on Ukrainian territory occupied by the Germans by the end of 1941. The most notorious and outrageous massacre took place September 29th and 30th, 1941, in Babi Yar, Kiev. All kikes of the city of Kiev and its vicinity must appear on Monday, September 29th, by 8 o'clock in the morning. Bring documents, money, and valuables, and also warm clothing, linen, etc. Any kikes who do not follow this order and are found elsewhere will be shot. 33,771 Jews were killed in this two-day operation of the Nazis and Ukrainian militia. Another outrageous massacre was carried out by the Ukrainian Insurgent Army and the Bandera faction of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists in German-occupied Polish Volhynia and eastern Galicia between 1943 and 1944. This genocide of Poles was led by Mykola Lebed. 35,000 to 60,000 people in Volhynia and 25,000 to 40,000 in eastern Galicia fell victim to this massive ethnic cleansing operation. Sensing the inevitable loss of the German troops, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists gave up on their former ally and began fighting equally against the Germans and the Soviet forces. In January 1943, USSR troops started pushing the Nazis back, liberating one part of Ukraine after another. Western Ukraine was the last Ukrainian region held by the Germans, finally being liberated in October of 1944. Bandera's bands continued to wage their guerrilla war against the Soviet regime, carrying out bloody raids on Ukrainian villages and towns, and leaving behind chaos and casualties. This war went on until the middle of the 1950s, when the last collaborators were either detained or fled the country. On May 7, 1945, Germany unconditionally surrendered to the Allies. Ukraine remained a part of the Soviet Union. The peace after the Second World War was short-lived. The United States and the Soviet Union, nations who allied together along with England to defeat the Nazis, tragically became foes as the Cold War began. The era of political and military tension between the U.S. and the USSR lasted for nearly 45 years, keeping humanity under the constant threat of nuclear war. In this battle, the United States never lost sight of Ukraine's importance. U.S. intelligence kept a close eye on Ukrainian nationalist organizations as a possible source of counterintelligence against the Soviet Union. CIA documents that just recently have been declassified show strong ties between U.S. intelligence and Ukrainian nationalists since 1946. From the CIA agency report, it is clear that they were not mistaken about the nature of Ukrainian nationalist organizations or their leader, Stepan Bandera himself. According to an OSS report of September 1945, Bandera had earned a fierce reputation for conducting a reign of terror during World War II. After the Second World War, Bandera and other Ukrainian Nazi leaders fled to Europe, where the CIA helped them hide. The CIA later informed the Immigration and Naturalization Service that it had concealed Stepan Bandera and other Ukrainians from the Soviets. The operations involving Ukrainians continued for many years. The Nuremberg trials of 1945 and 1946 brought the political, economic, and military leaders of fascist Germany to justice and revealed to the world the monstrous face of Nazism and the crimes they committed. But the Ukrainian Nazis were spared the same fate, and some were even granted indulgences by the CIA. By 1954, the agency excused the illegal activities of the OUN security branch in the name of Cold War necessity. In 1949, Mykola Lebed, the man responsible for the massacres in Volhynia, was moved to the United States, where he died in 1989 without ever being investigated or pursued as a war criminal. The CIA moved to protect Ukrainian nationalist leader Mykola Lebed from criminal investigation by the Immigration and Naturalization Service in 1952. Perhaps Bandera lost his use to the U.S., or maybe KGB agents outsmarted the CIA, but in 1959, Stepan Bandera, the leader of the Ukrainian nationalists, was killed in Munich, where he was hiding under the name of Stefan Popel. It would be fair to say that Bandera became a major symbol of Ukrainian nationalism by sheer chance, for he was neither its only leader nor its most powerful one. Dmytro Dontsov was the father of the far-right totalitarian doctrine in Ukraine. Andriy Melnyk was the leader of another faction of the OUN. Roman Shuhevich was a general of the Ukrainian insurgent army, and others contributed greatly to the movement. Bandera's dangerous ideology, suppressed by the communist authorities, but supported by external forces, never really died. The seeds of Ukrainian nationalism were passed from generation to generation. Unfortunately, it was just a matter of time before they would once again blossom. In 1954, Ukraine's territory was expanded even more when Nikita Khrushchev, the leader of the USSR, and a Ukrainian himself, generously gave the Crimean region to Ukraine. Historians would argue about the legitimacy of this transfer for many years to come, and 60 years after Khrushchev's gift, dramatic new events would take place in Crimea.
The eyes of the world are on Ukraine as the crisis in Crimea continues.
Dozens of heavily armed men seized government buildings in Crimea.
Should Ukraine just shrug its shoulders and say, okay, Crimea, it's lost?
And the old arguments would heat up once again. The Cold War would heat up and cool down by turns, while both rivals were obsessively building up military capacity. The turning point took place when the new era, Perestroika, came to the USSR with its new leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, in the middle of the 1980s. Perestroika meant restructuring towards liberalization and democratization. It certainly had a positive impact on the international situation.
Astonishing news from East Germany. where the East German authorities have said, in essence, that the Berlin Wall doesn't mean anything anymore.
But inside the USSR, the weakening of Kremlin control had different consequences. In Ukraine, a nationalistic political organization, Narodny Rukh, or People's Movement, emerged in 1989 due to this new openness. They advocated for independence of Ukraine from the USSR and became an incubator for leaders of Ukrainian neo-Nazism. In 1991, one of them, Oleg Tyagnibok, founded Svoboda, an openly radical nationalist party preaching the good old principles of Bandera. Purge Ukraine from the Jews and Russians, Ukraine for Ukrainians, and so on. His statements got him fifth place in the Simon Wiesenthal Center top 10 anti-Semitic world leader rankings of 2012, but also, sadly, attracted numerous followers. Dmitry Yarosh founded another extreme right organization, Trizu, or Trident, in 1994. In April 2013, Yarosh became an assistant to a member of parliament from the opposition party UDAR. Later that same year, he would become the leader of the most radical Ukrainian Nazi group, the Right Sector. Andriy Paruby would soon appear leading a whole army of ultra-nationalist warriors. And the torch marches would once again light up the streets of Ukrainian cities. The world drastically changed in August 1991, when the USSR de facto ceased to exist and the global political map welcomed many newcomers, Ukraine one of them. In modern history, it was the first time Ukraine was truly independent and all on its own.
The red flag came down over the Kremlin tonight as President Gorbachev resigned and brought to an end 7 decades of communist rule in the Soviet Union.
The years after the disintegration of the USSR became known as the Crazy 90s in all the post-Soviet territories.
He's leaving behind 15 independent states which share only a disastrous economy and an uncertain future.
After having been under a government-controlled economy, the free market dramatically changed the rules of the game. New businesses emerged instantly, and the first oligarchs were born overnight. The former country with no class division suddenly became stratified. The chosen few became rich, while the rest had to fight to survive. The people's growing discontent made Ukraine more vulnerable to outside forces, and a new kind of warfare was launched, one not known before, the color revolutions.
Demonstrators clash with police, hundreds of thousands protesting the results of the election and calling for a new vote.
Ukraine has had two color revolutions in its 24 years of independence. In 2004, crowds of people descended upon Kiev, marking the start of the Orange Revolution. At that time, Ukraine became once again a battlefield of two forces, the Russian and Western governments. The culmination of this conflict took place during the presidential elections in November of 2004. The two major candidates, Western-backed Viktor Yushchenko and Russian-leaning Viktor Yanukovych, almost equally shared the votes of Ukrainians. By the way, calling Viktor Yushchenko Western-backed is not an exaggeration. His wife, Katerina Yushchenko, is a former U.S. State Department official and worked in the White House during the Reagan administration. The division was along geographic lines. Traditionally, Russian Eastern Ukraine voted for Yanukovych, while Western Ukraine chose Yushchenko. By the announced result, Viktor Yushchenko lost to Viktor Yanukovych, but thousands of people didn't agree with it, and they came to the central square of Kiev on the 22nd of November. The situation received wide news coverage.
The country's election commission ignored reports of fraud, declaring Kremlin-backed Viktor Yanukovych the winner.
International politicians, such as former General Secretary of NATO, Javier Solana, became frequent guests in Kiev, initiating negotiations between parties.
And I hope very much, and the goodwill of everybody, will be able to overcome this difficulty.
The results of the negotiations, however, were often reached only on paper. Thus, Yushchenko never told the supporters to stop blocking government buildings in central Kiev. Therefore, these non-violent and very orange protests lasted for a month, during which time the previous election results were annulled, marred by massive corruption, and new elections were announced. An important nuance, just 3 months before, Viktor Yushchenko became a victim to a mysterious and still unsolved poisoning. But it didn't prevent him from winning in the new election. Though, as we shall soon see, there was much more than just the people's will that led to this victory. This peaceful revolution and its leader were warmly welcomed by the international community. But the euphoria didn't last long. Yushchenko's government completely failed with reforms and lost its chance to establish democracy, instead descending into infighting. Viktor Yushchenko was not reelected for a second term, but at the end of his presidency, he had the time to make one last gift to his supporters from Western Ukraine. The hero status of Stepan Bandera was short-lived. In 2010, Viktor Yanukovych was elected president. This time, the international community had no doubts about the legitimacy of the elections. In January 2011, Viktor Yanukovych repealed the hero title of Bandera. Almost 4 years into his presidency, though, another revolution shook Ukraine. Unfortunately, this one was anything but peaceful.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Limiting the Environmental Protection Agency with restrictions issued by the US Supreme Court at a time when fossil fuel emissions need to be curbed is devastating. We now present you an article written by Ayurella Hornmuller. The piece is titled Condemning Everyone Alive: Outrage at US Supreme Court Climate Ruling. Amid heat records being shattered across the world and historic wildfires raging across western United States, climate activists and policymakers working to aggressively curb greenhouse gas emissions are now facing a new kind of challenge: restrictions issued by the U.S. Supreme Court. Recently, the Supreme Court released a ruling in West Virginia versus the Environmental Protection Agency, limiting the Environmental Protection Agency's power to regulate emissions from fossil fuel-fired power plants, in a major environmental case with far-reaching impacts. This has been classified a devastating outcome by environmental lawyers, climate scientists, and activists alike, one with far-reaching implications for the future of the country and the world. Ginger Cassidy, Executive Director of Rainforest Action Network, said, "At this point, for those in positions of high power to deny the urgency and the stakes of the climate crisis is to condemn everyone alive today and generations to come to life in a sick and impoverished world." The court's conservative majority voted 6-3 in favor of leading coal producer West Virginia in a lawsuit that challenges originally brought by 20 other Republican attorney generals who sued for the Environmental Protection Agency to have less regulatory power over existing power plants without express authorization from Congress under the Clean Air Act. In the ruling, the court's conservative supermajority determined that the Clean Air Act does not authorize anything other than direct regulation of power plants. Senior attorney Frank Rambo, who leads the energy program at the Southern Environmental Law Center, said, "Global climate change is the underlying environmental challenge of this day and age, and the United States is the leading contributor to that globally. The ability of our federal government to get a handle on our contribution to climate change is what's at stake. It's likely the ruling will spell trouble for Joe Biden's climate targets, which include cleaning up the electric power grid in order to meet a national goal of 100% carbon pollution-free electricity by 2035 and net zero carbon emissions by 2050. In a statement, the President Joe Biden responded to the ruling. "The Supreme Court's ruling in West Virginia versus the Environmental Protection Agency is another devastating decision that aims to take our country backwards. While this decision risks damaging our nation's ability to keep our air clean and combat climate change, I will not relent in using my lawful authorities to protect public health and tackle the climate crisis." The Environmental Protection Agency also issued a response saying they are reviewing the court's decision. "Environmental Protection Agency is committed to using the full scope of its existing authorities to protect public health and significantly reduce environmental pollution, which is in alignment with the growing clean energy economy." Sarah Jordan, an assistant professor researching environmental life cycle assessments at Johns Hopkins University, said, "It's important to remember that this ruling will not take away from climate momentum in states that are utilizing their power to make this shift towards clean energy." Sarah Jordan said, "What it really impacts is the ability to enforce change in the states that are out there that have large fossil fuel resources and that are determined to continue to utilize those technologies that bring those resources. But there is an obvious limit to how much can be done without national intervention." David Konitsky, a professor of public and environmental affairs at Indiana University, said, "If we think about the total U.S. portfolio and trying to reduce emissions across the country, there's only so much you can achieve without having a national strategy." The latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, report found that unless countries across the world aggressively cut emissions, limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, compared with pre-industrial levels, will be out of reach. If that threshold is exceeded, the human and environmental harms from climate change will become excessively dangerous, affecting nearly every aspect of human life, further driving mass climate migration and making adaptation everywhere increasingly difficult. Regulating emissions from power plants is a vital piece of climate mitigation, as the power sector is the second largest planet warming polluter in the United States, making up about 25% of national carbon emissions. Now, Konitsky says the Environmental Protection Agency will have to go back to the drawing board to try to come up with a federal program that the court may endorse. In the meantime, experts noted the domino effect of not rapidly eliminating national greenhouse gas emissions will disproportionately fall to black, brown, and indigenous communities as worsening climate crisis deepens racial and social divides. U.S. Climate Action Network's executive director, Kia Chatterjee, said, "There are so many paths to climate justice still, but what we're seeing is a Supreme Court that I would call the supreme climate deniers that are trying to put themselves in a decision-making position." Kia Chatterjee added, "That sends a signal that they will want to make it harder for the federal government to protect people in communities where right now the fossil fuel industry is running the show." The Sunrise Movement, a youth-led climate organization, wrote, "Decisions like West Virginia versus the Environmental Protection Agency makes it clear just how much the system is rigged against us. A Supreme Court that sides with the fossil fuel industry over the health and safety of its people is anti-life and illegitimate." Chatterjee said, "Any decision that cuts off climate action is outrageous, given that we're already in a crisis." But she added, "But it's time for them to find their spine, find their guts, and make the decisions they need to make on the climate crisis. That's also time for them to fix this institution."
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Since the start of the war in Ukraine back in February, the prices of commodities have risen up sharply. But the rising prices of grain raise concerns about possible famine in different parts of the world. Russia and Ukraine together export nearly a third of the world's wheat and barley, more than 70% of its sunflower oil, and are prominent suppliers of corn. Russia is also the top global fertilizer producer. Russia has been accused of disruption in the transport of grain harvest in Ukraine. UN projections show that up to 181 million people in 41 countries could face a food crisis or even an outright famine. UK's Foreign Secretary Liz Truss has accused Moscow of using grain as a weapon.
Food should never be used as a weapon of war, but that's what we're seeing in Ukraine, with Putin's forces blocking the ports and stopping grain being exported around the world.
However, a look at history and UK's global imperialism reveals that London has often resorted to blockades to further its colonial ambitions. Starvation was a conscious resource for Britain's colonial projects. The starvation approach was used against countries like Ireland, Iran, India, Malaysia, and Nigeria. Meanwhile, blockades and sanctions has been used against a whole host of countries like Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe, to name a few, which all point to how the UK has used food as a weapon of war.
The UK throne symbolizes all forms of evil and genocide that we can imagine in human history. And England and the Crown in particular are the representatives of that. For centuries, they have extracted their wealth from oppressed peoples around the world, have shored up their pockets, have used financial schemes to colonize and oppress peoples around the world, to divide and conquer oppressed peoples in order to gain wealth.
The famine of 1845 to 1852 in Ireland was a man-made instrument of war and conquest. Over 1 million Irish people died of starvation. 1.5 million more left Ireland, many on coffin ships. Before the genocide, the population of Ireland stood at over 8 million. 150 years later, and the population has never reached that figure. Mass starvation was a regular feature of life in India under British rule. The last famine that was inflicted on India was in 1943, when over 4 million people died in Bengal. The British Army took millions of tons of rice from starving people. Even when other nations tried to send aid to the people of Bengal, Winston Churchill refused the offers. Britain's imperial project in India, its aim and methods was not to prevent famines, but to engineer them. During the so-called Malayan Emergency of 1948 to 1960, the British introduced a food denial program called Operation Starvation. Its aim was to starve out those who were resisting Britain's looting of the country. When Iran was occupied by British and Russian forces during World War I and II, countless Iranians died because they were denied food by the occupying imperial forces.
It has been involved with certain genocides and, of course, the first war in Iran and so forth to kill, thousands of lives lost of Iranians. If we look back in history, this has not been, it has not only happened once, it has happened many times.
Iran declared itself neutral in both wars, but millions of Iranians lost their lives due to widespread famine and disease. In the late 1960s, the British armed and supplied Nigeria with mercenaries during the Biafran War in the name of protecting corporate oil. When it looked like Nigeria got the upper hand, Britain increased the supply of arms and ammunition. Britain supported a blockade against them, which resulted in countless people starving to death. The UK's imperial history shows that the regime in London tends not to care about the plight of people facing famine and hunger, and London's comments about using grain as weapon are a ploy to conceal its dark history.
NATO leaders have held a meeting in the Spanish capital, Madrid, to discuss the expansion of the military alliance. NATO has formally invited Sweden and Finland to join the US-led military alliance. This is a historic expansion of the 30-member bloc. The military bloc, in a collective decision, approved the applications of Sweden and Finland a day after Turkey dropped its objections to the move. The decision will now be referred to the parliament and legislators of the NATO member states for final ratification. The process is likely to move swiftly as the US-led military alliance seeks to build a bigger front against Russian President Vladimir Putin. Finland and Sweden applied to join NATO after Russia launched a special military operation in its neighbor Ukraine in February. NATO has officially declared Russia the most significant and direct threat to the security of its members. That marks a radical strategic shift spurred by the Russian military offensive against Ukraine.
It's the first time this new vision of Russia and its role in Europe is reflected in the strategic document of the Atlantic Alliance. Until recently, until this summit, NATO operated within the framework of the old strategy that was adopted back in 2010 at the Lisbon summit, and this strategy described Russia as a strategic partner of the NATO alliance. So we have a very decisive, a very radical shift in the approach.
And for the first time in its history, NATO has listed China as one of its strategic priorities, claiming that Beijing's ambitions challenge the Western bloc's interests, security, and values. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says China is not a threat, but the alliance needs to be clear-eyed about the challenges it represents.
This shift will definitely color many new initiatives and steps taken by NATO, including its defense posture, its deployment patterns, including its rhetoric, So it is a kind of very important formal step which nails down the new normal and which will have a significant impact of what NATO is likely to plan in years to come.
Both Russia and China have reacted angrily to the accusations and threats directed against them by the NATO. Beijing has slammed NATO's warning as completely futile. In their recent gathering, NATO leaders said Beijing's ambitions, policies, and close ties to Russia pose a challenge to the interests and security of the military alliance. China has accused the alliance of, quote, maliciously attacking and smearing the country. Its mission to the European Union said NATO claims that other countries pose challenges, but it is NATO that is creating problems around the world. The confrontational rhetoric comes as the U.S. is stepping up efforts to increase its military presence in Europe.
Apparently, the assumption is that with more Western weapons coming to Ukraine, with more military assistance reaching Kyiv, with more exhaustion on the Russian side, the course of the military conflict might shift in Ukraine's favor, and that with time, Ukraine's negotiating positions might get stronger.
U.S. President Joe Biden pledged more American troops, warplanes, and warships for Europe. The U.S. has pledged over $5 billion in U.S. aid, yet Ukraine is losing the war. It is now believed the U.S. and Western allies are deliberately protracting the war to station more weapons and troops across Europe and militarize the public discourse.
The United States is drumming up support from regional nations in East and West Asia to unite under alliances against Washington's perceived threats. According to a Wall Street Journal report, the U.S. held secret meetings with senior Israeli and Arab military figures, namely from Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Jordan, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain at the Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh in March. The talks were focused on Iran. Washington has been mulling the idea of forming a regional alliance against Tehran by bringing those with strained relations with Iran closer to Israel for quite some time now. The Abraham Accords, under which several Arab nations normalized their ties with Israel, is widely believed to have been part of the plan. This is while Iran is taking diplomatic steps to strengthen ties with its regional neighbors, which may include some of the very nations that are being considered by Washington as potential anti-Tehran allies. The Islamic Republic and Saudi Arabia have been engaged in talks aimed at the normalization of their bilateral relations over the past few months. Iranian and Emirati officials have also expressed willingness to restore warmer ties in recent months.
What we can observe is the world as a whole is moving towards a more multipolar world where countries are not afraid to be in relationship with one another despite U.S. interests. And we see this happening all throughout the world. And we can simply look to the summit of the, because that was a failed attempt at the U.S. to kind of bully itself into remaining and enforcing its U.S. hegemony in other places throughout the world. And so with recent events that have been happening around the world, the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the U.S. trying to again impose U.S. hegemony in other places throughout the world, we see countries moving further and further away from U.S. interests and really focusing on building with one another in the best interests of their own countries.
That poses some serious questions about the effectiveness of a potential U.S.-backed regional anti-Iran coalition. North Korea has accused the United States of trying to set up a NATO-style military alliance in Asia, saying Washington continues to hold military maneuvers with East Asian states despite Pyongyang's warnings. In a statement posted on its official website on Sunday, North Korea's foreign ministry said Washington is making a, quote, full-fledged move to establish an Asia-style NATO while blatantly holding joint military exercises with Japan and South Korea. The remarks come on the heels of recent joint exercises by the US, South Korean, and Japanese forces, which involved a US aircraft carrier for the first time in more than 4 years. In a meeting after the drills, North Korean officials condemned aggressive moves by Washington and Seoul, pledging to take revenge on the US imperialists as they mark the 72nd anniversary of the outbreak of the Korean War. Why is it that Washington prefers setting up military deterrence when it can resolve conflicts through diplomatic means? Wouldn't that be a less costly and more efficient way of diffusing tensions?
We live in a world where, with all the nuances of North Korea, with all the misinformation that we are told about North Korea, the U.S. is trying to create fear without actual evidence. So what we can expect in upcoming months is that the U.S. is going to try to make it seem as if North Korea is the aggressor, as if they are not doing military exercises right outside of North Korea's borders, to provoke and to create the conditions to justify military actions and military exercises against the people in North Korea that have chosen to continue to build their country in favor of a one Korea and reuniting their countries and moving away from U.S. Interests.
The history of U.S.-led alliances, including that of NATO, shows that more often than not, they fail to accomplish their self-declared objectives. It wouldn't come as a surprise if newer ones won't have a different fate.
Strikes in Europe's transport sector have disrupted air flights and train schedules as transportation companies struggle to cope with rising demand at the start of the peak of summer travel season after COVID restrictions were lifted. A strike by staff members at Irish Airline, Ryanair, and Brussels Airlines over pay and working conditions forced the cancellation of many flights. The workers' strike also disrupted flight schedules in Spain, Italy, France, Portugal, and Belgium. Meanwhile, earlier this week, the British railway system once again came to a halt. Tens of thousands of workers have walked in Britain's biggest rail strike in 30 years, with millions of passengers facing days of chaos as both the unions and the government have stuck to their guns in a row over pay. The British Transport Union, the National Union of Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers, RMT, threatened to continue the industrial action until managers address the workers' grievances and meet their salary demands. According to the UK government career service, RMT members who are not high earners, for example train guards and track maintenance staff, earn somewhere between £20,000 to £35,000. But the union says its members deserve more. Despite the ongoing negotiations between representatives from the management and staff, the media predicted the strikes to continue. They attributed further industrial action to the rapidly rising inflation rates exacerbated by sluggish economic growth, saying this combo will likely lead to more worker strikes across the European continent in the summer ahead.
The people who are on strike have been pretty clear about it, including in Great Britain with the railroads, the airline pilots, and everybody else. For some years, they've been in trouble and there have been increasing social unrest. And what's happening now is a huge increase in inflation and hence a decrease in purchasing power, and people's standard of living is going down. And so you're having a confluence of events. You have this economic crisis, then you have this people saying, listen, we cannot let the war in Ukraine completely derail the environmental crisis. And furthermore, the policies, as another group saying, look, the policies that we're pursuing, that our governments are pursuing in Ukraine, are adding to the problem, not making it better.
Unions have said the rail strikes could mark the start of a summer of discontent, with teachers, medics, and even waste disposal workers heading for industrial action as inflation pushes 10%. Inflation has soared across Europe on the back of a major rise in energy costs, and Britain is not alone in facing strikes. Russia's war in Ukraine pushed the already rising inflation in countries that use the euro to a record high in May, with energy projected to have the steepest annual rate. As the war in Ukraine drags on through its fourth month, the West, led by US and NATO, remains largely united in backing Kyiv. But they are divided over how long they're willing to endure the conflict's economic fallout. The prospect of a drawn-out conflict with the battle raging in eastern Ukraine has raised questions about whether war fatigue, coupled with skyrocketing food prices and energy bills, could test countries' political will to keep pressuring Moscow over time. In the US, President Joe Biden blamed the Russians for rising US gas prices, saying it was outrageous what the war in Ukraine is causing. Hungary, on the other hand, has called for immediate peace talks to end the war between Ukraine and Russia, warning that a prolonged conflict will fuel an economic crisis that will imperil governments across Europe. Meanwhile, the United Nations has warned of an unprecedented global hunger crisis in light of the recent developments.
There's a couple of different things going on here. There is the United States as an outlier in NATO in a certain sense, with some of the Eastern European companies really pushing for more and more aggressive behavior by NATO in Ukraine. You have other countries which are in Western Europe who are suffering from the United States activities here, the real pressure economically, and are beginning to say, wait a minute, this is not what we really want to have here. Our population's getting upset. And then you have apparently the failure of the sanctions. And in the United States press, at least, the understanding that maybe they're not going to work so well. And so the Russians are not going to be suffering so much.
Western countries rallied around Kyiv when Russia began its military operation in Ukraine in February. But now that unity is being tested as soaring inflation and energy shortages rebound on their own citizens.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Without UNRWA's services, Palestine refugees in Syria, Lebanon, and Gaza face a potential, or in some cases even more dire, humanitarian crisis. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Dalal Yassin, activist. This article is published under the heading, Is This the End of UNRWA? Here's the story. In his April 2022 message to Palestinian refugees, Philip Lazzarini, Commissioner General of UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, said the agency is cash-strapped and that it has become almost customary for the person in his position to beg for help if he wants the services to continue. Throughout the message, he emphasized the chronic underfunding of UNRWA, only to note that the agency is exploring how to maximize partnerships within the broader UN system. This cryptic statement, what does it mean exactly if UNRWA were to maximize partnerships within the broader UN system, has raised concerns among Palestinians that UNRWA will be disbanded, its services dispersed among other UN agencies or non-governmental organizations. UNRWA was established in December 1949 to provide relief to Palestine refugees created by the Nakba, or the forcible expulsion of Palestinians from their own homeland to create the fabricated regime of Israel. Today, some 5 million refugees are eligible, according to UNRWA, to receive its social services, education, and healthcare. However, the agency has been forced to steadily reduce those services due to lack of funds. Yet, Lazzarini said in his April message that such partnerships, as in those within the broader UN system, have the potential to protect essential services and your rights from chronic underfunding. Without UNRWA services, Palestine refugees in Syria, Lebanon, and Gaza face a potential, or in some cases, even more dire, humanitarian crisis. In Syria, 82% of Palestine refugees live on less than $1.90 a day. In Lebanon, 86% of Palestine refugees live below the poverty line. Meanwhile, Palestinians in Gaza have been under siege and persistent attacks by the Zionist regime for almost 2 decades. UNRWA reports that 1.2 million Palestinians in Gaza need food assistance. Although Palestinian refugees' right of return is enshrined in international law, Palestinians fear that their rights will be further diminished without a UN agency to provide basic services. UNRWA's mandate, which is renewed every 3 years by the UN General Assembly, includes a commitment to assist and protect Palestine refugees until a just solution to the Palestine refugee question is reached. In December 2019, the General Assembly extended UNRWA's mandate until June 2023. The measure was passed with overwhelming support despite the lone objections of the United States and the Zionist regime. As UNRWA prepares for a new General Assembly vote at the end of 2022 to renew its mandate, the agency faces a financial deficit of roughly $100 million. This is not a new dilemma for UNRWA. Donor pledges to UNRWA totaled approximately $412 million in 2022, a drastic decrease from years prior, such as in 2018 when pledges to UNRWA totaled $1.3 billion, and that was despite the Donald Trump administration's elimination of approximately $300 million of its anticipated contributions to UNRWA that year. While Arab states have typically provided a quarter of UNRWA's budget, those